tonight, our final session will be the history of slavery in America. The difference between the attitude towards slavery between the North and the South in America can best be explained by tracing each to the fundamental roots of its respective culture. The Pilgrims and the Puritans of New England were largely church families, made up of individual family units with husbands and wives and children all traveling together, other young men and young ladies that would come to the New World and wind up getting married and starting their own families, but they were coming here to stay and to build a whole new life for themselves in the New World. As members of these groups were in fact outcasts from England, they were Puritans and they were pilgrims. They were not the traditional Anglican churchmen, and they were not of that aristocratic society. They formed a classless society of equals here in America, as all men were equal at the foot of the cross. However, the first settlers in the South established Jamestown in 1607. 144 men came over. No women or children. Does it sound like they're trying to build families over here? No, I don't think so. They were on a search for gold is their primary motive. And they were members of the Anglican Church, the Church of England, and as such, they were steeped in a society of nobility, the idea of gentlemen and class. And of course, a gentleman would not do manual labor. They'd rather die first than betray their class by soiling their hands. So the gentleman would explore and trade with the Indians or raid the Indians if necessary. But these descendants of aristocrats or wannabe aristocrats believed that farming was beneath them. In fact, upon their arrival in 1607, the gentleman immediately began searching the oysters for pearls while the laborers unloaded the ship. The old world of aristocracy, of the sophisticate versus the working class, was established from the beginning in the South. So we see that the seeds of difference were planted at the birth of each society. One group fostering a classless society, and the other fostering the ideas of aristocracy and laborer classes. Well, this contrast was most evident with the first introduction of slaves in the New World to both the North and the South. A gentleman by the name of W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in his book, Suppression of the African Slave Trade in the United States of America from 1638 to 1670, said this in summary, slave trade to North America commenced with a Dutch ship bringing 20 Africans and 90 women to Virginia in late August 1619. In 1640, by contrast, a certain Captain Smith, as it was quoted in the book, attacked an African village and brought some of the natives to Massachusetts. He was promptly arrested, and these native Africans were sent back home at the colony's expense. So you can see the contrast in attitude towards slavery between the northern immigrants and the southern immigrants. However, as sin creeps in little by little, eventually the presence of black slaves was accepted to differing extents in the colonies. It was never greatly popular in the North, always minimal, and most were serving as house servants, but to greater and harsher degrees in the southern colonies. Let me stop here for a moment and add a parenthetical insert before I continue. The fact that there was even one slave for one day in America is a black mark on our history. However, America was not the author or the perfecter of slavery, as the liberal press would like you to believe. The first slave identified in Scripture was Joseph, a Jew. The first noted slave race was the nation of Israel, as they were captive for some 400 years in Egypt. Today we speak of slavery as if it's in the past tense, but ladies and gentlemen, that is not true. There are estimates today that as many as 27 million slaves are still in existence around the world. Historically, African tribes were the first slave masters, enslaving other African tribesmen and selling them into slavery. As a matter of fact, according to a BBC report dated September 3rd, 2001, over the four centuries of slave trade from 1450 to 1850, some 12 million slaves were taken to North and South America and the West Indies. But ladies and gentlemen, of that 12 million, and I know only one slave is too many, but of the 12 million, only 500,000 were brought to North America. Percentage-wise, less than 5% were actually brought to the New World here in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, according to that same report, Muslim traders exported 17 million Africans into the Middle East. By the way, Not only did they export Africans, but the Muslim traders, in particular the Barbary pirates, used to raid the coasts of the European colonies as well, and also American shipping. And over 1.25 million white people were captured by these same Muslim traders and sold into slavery. And again, slavery is not out of existence. There are 27 million slaves in the world today. But thank God that in the United States of America, it only took 74 years from the time that the Constitution was ratified until Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Well, according to David Barton's research, the majority of our founding fathers were in fact abolitionists. Let me quote from one of his books: "The founders did not just believe slavery was an evil that needed to be abolished, and they did not just speak against it, but they acted on their beliefs. During the Revolutionary War, black slaves who fought won their freedom in every state except South Carolina and Georgia. Many of the founders started and served in anti-slavery societies. Franklin and Rush founded the first such society in America in 1774. John Jay was president of a similar society in New York. Other founding fathers served in anti-slavery societies included William Livingston, who was a signer of the Constitution, James Madison, Richard Bassett, James Monroe, Bushrod Washington, Charles Carroll, William Few, John Marshall, Richard Stockton, Zephaniah Swift, and many more. Before our nation's independence, some states had tried to restrict slavery in different ways. For example, Virginia had voted to end the slave trade in 1773, but the English government would not allow it. Following independence and after victory in the war, the rule of the mother country was removed, leaving freedom for each state to deal with the slavery problem. Within about 20 years of the 1783 Treaty of Peace with Britain, the northern states abolished slavery. Pennsylvania and Massachusetts in 1780, Connecticut and Rhode Island in 1784, New Hampshire in 1792, Vermont in 1793, New York in 1799, and New Jersey in 1804. That's something that you're not taught in the modern classroom about America anymore. But this evening I want to examine the Constitution and what took place within that period of time, that generation that followed. Ladies and gentlemen, the Hate America First crowd tries to put forth the notion that the Constitution was a racist document because of a particular clause that's called the Three-Fifths Clause. Nothing could be further from the truth. According to the great abolitionist and former slave Frederick Douglass, he said this: "I am convinced that the Constitution of the United States not only contained no guarantees in favor of slavery, but on the contrary, it is in its letter and spirit an anti-slavery instrument, demanding the abolition of slavery as a condition of its own existence as the supreme law of the land. The Constitution is a glorious liberty document. Read its preamble. Consider its purposes. Is slavery among them? If the Constitution were intended to be, by its framers and adopters, a slaveholding instrument, why neither slavery, slaveholding, nor slave can be found anywhere within it? Now take the Constitution according to its plain reading, and I defy the presentation of a single pro-slavery clause in it. On the other hand, it will be found to contain principles and purposes entirely hostile to the existence of slavery." As I noted a moment ago about our founders, most of the delegates at the Constitutional Convention opposed slavery. However, Georgia and South Carolina threatened to walk out and bring an end to the whole proceedings. Now, some thought it would be a good idea to go ahead and let them leave and just carry on without them, but they all recognized two things. Number one, slavery was obviously going to continue in those two states even if they walked out. There was nothing they could do to stop it at that time. Number two, a strong union was their best means of securing survival. And as you will see, steps were taken within the document to bring slavery to an end. But even with conceding the demands to Georgia and South Carolina, the end of slavery was intended with the Constitution. Consider this excerpt, words from the Vice President of the Confederacy, Alexander Stephens, in a speech that he made on March the 22nd, 1861, a speech entitled "African Slavery, the Cornerstone of the Southern Confederacy." He said this and admitted the prevailing ideas entertained by him, speaking of Thomas Jefferson, and most of the leading statesmen at the time of the formation of the old Constitution were that the enslavement of the African was in violation of the laws of nature, that it was wrong in principle, socially, morally, and politically. And it was an evil that they knew not well how to deal with, but the general opinion of the men of that day was that somehow or other, in the order of providence, the institution would be evanescent or temporary and pass away. Well, three things happened in 1787 that were intended to bring an end to slavery. Item number one was held within the Constitution itself. The federal government agreed for 20 years that it would make no law against the importation of quote-unquote immigrants. You notice that slave is not used anywhere in the Constitution. But a 20 years moratorium on making any law regarding immigrants into the new country. But what did that mean? That meant that 20 years from the date that was signed, they could, in fact, end the slave trade. That was quite a concession, really, when you think about it, that was made by those two southern states. Second item of importance was, in fact, the three-fifths clause. As I said a few minutes ago, the liberals, even to this day, try to say that the three-fifths clause was demeaning to blacks by considering that a black was worth only 60% of a white. Wrong, wrong, wrong. This formula was to be used in calculating representation in the House of Representatives. The more members of the House of Representatives that were from slaveholding states, the more difficult it would be to do away with slavery. In some southern states, there was nearly a 1-to-1 ratio between blacks and whites, or between slaves and free men. Also note that in the Constitution, the word slave is not used. The words free persons and bound to service are the two terms that are used. By the way, there were many free blacks that were just that. They were free. They had the right to vote. They had the right to own property and other things. Blacks and whites served alongside one another in many military units in the War for Independence. A free man, according to the Constitution, black or white, counted as one. Again, a free man, regardless of color, counted as one. But those, and I quote, bound to service, unquote, counted for only three-fifths, which meant that for every 30,000 free men residents, you got one representative. But it took 50,000 slaves, or those bound to service, in order to get one representative. Therefore, this was an incredibly bright strategy in order to weaken the representation in the southern states and bring more hastily the end of slavery in America. Now, the hypocrisy of Georgia and South Carolina was never more evident than in this debate. They claimed, on one hand, that their slaves were property. Then, on the other hand, they claimed that they were persons. Their property, therefore, they had no individual rights. But as far as calculating the representation in Congress, they counted them as persons, even though they couldn't vote. Can you see the hypocrisy in all this? And delegates from the northern states kept trying to press them, well, which way is it? Are they property or are they people? Governor Morris, a delegate from Pennsylvania, who, by the way, was the single largest contributor to the Constitution and an incredible Christian, argued. He said, upon what principle is it that the slaves shall be computed in the representation? Are they men? Then make them citizens and let them vote. Luther Martin from Maryland was sarcastic in some of his rhetoric dealing with the southern states, using their own reasoning against them. He said, if they were to be taken into account as property, then what peculiar circumstance should render this quote-unquote property entitled to the high privilege of conferring consequence and power in the government to its possessor rather than that of any other property? That is, why should slaves as quote-unquote property be taken into account rather than horses, cattle, mules, or any other type of quote-unquote property? Now, folks, the liberals will take a term like that, and they'll put an excerpt out there and try to make it sound like, well, look at this, he's comparing black people to mules. Baloney. Read the thing in context. The argument was, you all are hypocrites. You call them property, yet you want to count them in the census so you get representation in Congress. Well, if all they are is property, then I own some mules and some horses. That's my property. I want to count them for representation in Congress. So you can see the sarcasm, the wit, and the reason that was used against the South in this great debate. Well, that's what resulted in the three-fifths clause. Well, finally, by the way, I think this was providence because these are two different groups that were working. They were well aware of what was going on, but in fact working independently of one another. This providential act that was occurring in New York at the Congress of the Confederation, not the Constitutional Convention. This was the Congress under the Articles of the Confederation. They were passing at that very same time what was called the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, the area that was going to be brought into the states that was north and west of the Ohio River. Well, now it was property of the United States, and they were passing the rule of law for that new property. In time, that would become five states. Well, part of the laws that they passed regarding those incoming five states is that they would all be free states. Now think about this. There, they're debating over the Constitution. You've got 13 states. The majority are free states, but there's a handful of slaveholding states. And they were adamant about keeping the right to own slaves. At the same time, in New York, they were bringing in five more states that were all to be free states. Do you see the goal here? They believed that the balance of power would quickly tip and the free states could overwhelm via supermajority the southern states, and they would, in fact, be able to eliminate slavery altogether. Well, if all these great movements of freedom were taking place in 1787, then what happened? Well, one of the most important things that happened was the invention of the cotton gin by Eli Whitney in 1793. Prior to this, cotton was not a profitable product. It took a single person an entire day to clean the seeds out of 1 pound of cotton. But after the invention of the cotton gin, you could clean 50 pounds of cotton in a single day. And as a consequence, cotton rivaled tobacco as being the number one cash crop in the South. Another thing that happened, in 1820, most of the founding fathers were dead, and Thomas Jefferson's own party, the Democratic Party, which was the party of the South, took control in Congress. And after nearly 30 years of abolitionist progress, by the way, in 1807, the United States did vote to bring to an end the importation of slaves, as the founders had anticipated. But now the South, now the Southern Democrats were in the majority in Congress. And immediately in 1820, they passed the Missouri Compromise, which brought much more territory into the Union. But these future states, many of them would be slaveholding states rather than free states, as has been the case in the Northwest Ordinance. Then in 1850, the Fugitive Slave Law was passed, which made it illegal for Northerners to hide escaped slaves. But the bad thing about this is, bad as that is, it was even worse. Southerners could go into the North and just snatch black off the street and take them south and say they were escaped slaves, whether they had paperwork or not. What eventually happened is this drove many of the blacks in the North up into Canada trying to escape this kidnapping, this legalized kidnapping that was taking place in the South. Then in 1854, the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed with more slaveholding territory being added to the Union. And then in 1857, the democratically appointed Supreme Court ruled in the Dred Scott decision that blacks were not persons or citizens, but they were property. But something else happened about this time. In 1854, a new party was formed that had in its platform the elimination of slavery. That was the Republican Party. The platform of the 1856 Republican Party only had 9 planks, but foremost in the platform was the repeated and clear call for the end of slavery in America. Well, the Republicans lost that first presidential election in 1856. But in 1860, there was a split in the Democratic Party between the Northern Democrats, who supported slavery but opposed the thought of seceding from the Union, and the Southern Democrats, who supported slavery but were in favor of the thought of seceding from the Union. Well, this wound up splitting the Democrat vote between two different Democrats that were running, and with 40% of the popular election, the first Republican president, a man by the name of Abraham Lincoln, was elected as president of the United States. Of course, you know of the Emancipation Proclamation. You know of the war between the states and the amendment to eliminate slavery and to grant equal rights to blacks. But this you probably didn't know. After the war, Southerners had to take an oath of loyalty to the United States. And within that oath of loyalty, they had to swear to uphold and guarantee the rights of blacks as citizens and guarantee them full civil rights. Well, many flat out refused to do so. Consequently, they weren't allowed to vote. And as a consequence, the Republican Party controlled the South for many years. Did you know that the first 691 black state representatives and state senators that were elected to office in the former Confederate states were all Republicans? On July the 4th, 1867, the Republican Party of Texas was formed with 150 blacks and 20 whites. By 1872, there were seven former slaves that were now elected and serving in the halls of the United States Congress. Wow, that was incredible progress. But unfortunately, during this time, there was a new group forming in the South, which was an extension of the Democratic Party. Their goal was to oppose this group of radicals called the Republican Party. Well, this new group is known as the Ku Klux Klan. Literally, with voter fraud, this is where the concept of taking names off of gravestones, this is where the concept of voter intimidation, literally going in the voter booth, a white Southerner with a pistol escorting a black citizen into the voting booth to help him cast his vote. Voter intimidation, voter fraud, outright murder, and countless other filthy tactics, the Democratic South rose again, and racism was enforced for nearly another 80 years. Well, I know you've all heard of the great wickedness of lynchings in the racist South, but this I'm sure you didn't know. Between 1882 and 1964, there were 4,743 people lynched in the South. Of those 4,743, 3,446 victims were black, 1,297 victims were white. It wasn't just the murder of black people. It was the murder of black people and those that dared to stand with the black people. Well, now you know the history of slavery in America. Amazingly, in our generation, the invention of another era of dependency that's been fostered since the 1960s. We have seen the destruction of the family, in particular the black family, as what one time was one of the strongest family units in the country, as black families were devoutly religious. Now, vast majority are single-parent homes with no idea who the father is, with multiple kids all receiving government subsidies, being educated at the government schools, and unfortunately, that whole sector, that whole group of people is being weakened rather than strengthened. In our day and age, we see the concept of people depending on the government rather than self-sufficiency. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, we are very close to having more than 50% of the citizens of the United States receiving some sort of government subsidy. When that happens, the rascals will never be voted out of office because no one will vote to cut their benefits. And then it will be too late. It will be beyond the tipping point. But anyway, now you know the history of slavery in America and what a painful and ugly episode of American history it is. If only we'd listened to the Gouverneur Morrises, the John Jays, the Benjamin Rush, the Benjamin Franklins. Never was it right. But for a long time, it was legal. Thank God it's not legal anymore. But as we look back at that generation and we scratch our head and we wonder how on earth could people actually rationalize that and let that go by? We live in civilized America and we idly sit by and watch 3,000 unborn babies a day murdered in their mother's womb. Is it right? No, but unfortunately, thanks to the same group that was behind the racism in America, it is, in fact, legal. I pray that one of these days, just as slavery was recognized for what it was and what it is, a great wickedness and it was made illegal in our country. I pray that one day soon we will recognize that abortion too is a great evil in our country and brought to an end. And I pray that God's patience with America will not run out before that time occurs. But I do thank God for His providential hand in the history of the United States of America.